From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jane Clayson in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now. Millions of Americans woke up today with less weight on their shoulders. Financial weight, that is. Some or all of their student loans will be forgiven under a plan the White House announced yesterday. Now, some details are still on the way, but let's ask some initial questions about how this will work. Betsy Mayat is the founder of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors, and she's with us now. Hi, Betsy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. You speak to a lot of people with student debt. How might this change their financial futures, perhaps open up new possibilities for them?
Well, the prediction, based on the data that we have, is that the announcement yesterday is going to result in about a third of federal student loan borrowers not having any more student loans at all. And for many of them, that's going to be life-changing.
Yeah, give me an example or two of how these lives might change.
Well, if a borrower has been struggling to afford their student loans, and this announcement is going to end up forgiving all of their debt or the remainder of their debt, that's going to eliminate that struggle and free up some money to help them with maybe other bills that they have, even day-to-day expenses, retirement, saving for a home. The list goes on and on.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to some specifics of this plan. This affects people making less than $125,000 a year and families making up to $250,000 a year. What is the policy reasoning there to focus on this group?
Well, I think what they're trying to do is create a policy that provided relief to the most vulnerable borrowers and the ones that tend to struggle the most on their debt, and they did it based on income. Part of that is from a political standpoint, there's not a lot of appetite to forgive loans for someone that has a significant income and may not be struggling with their debt. So I think this was a way for the White House to sort of meet both of those political prongs, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And there is one provision for Pell Grant recipients, and their debt relief is up to $20,000. Who are those recipients? Help us understand who these people are.
Pell Grant recipients tend to be of the lowest income. So based on the federal calculation, it's assumed that the family really can't afford to contribute anything to college. So the Pell Grant's intended to help them to be able to afford to pay for college. But again, it's an indicator of the lowest sort of income and the families that tend to be struggling the most.
Okay. And does this new policy take effect immediately, automatically, or do debt holders have to apply for this, have to do something?
Well, that depends. For situations where the Department of Education already has the borrower's income information, for example, through the FAFSA, or if they've applied for an income-driven plan, it's going to be automatic. For borrowers where the Department of Education doesn't have their income information, there will be an application process.
Okay. And are those details on the way? I mean, is there kind of fuzziness as far as exactly what people need to do?
There's still a little bit of fuzziness. The announcement did say they were releasing an app or were going to have a tool online to make it as easy as possible for borrowers that do have to actually apply to do so. I do want to mention, too, this is an enormous undertaking. So the process is likely going to take months. I would expect that at the very least, it would take at least 6 months to get everything done. So I do want to caution your listeners that are going to benefit from this to be prepared to be a little bit patient.
Yeah. Now, one big question surrounding all of this is the high cost of college tuition. 40 years ago, the average tuition plus room and board was about $10,000 a year in this country. It's now almost triple that. Does this loan forgiveness plan begin to take on that question?
Well, I mean, they do talk in the announcement about trying to make some changes to make it that people don't have to take the debt on in the first place. But those are scant details. And there's really no active policy proposals out there that have any legs that do that. I mean, I say this all the time. Student loans are not the problem. They're the symptom of the problem. As you said, the problem is the cost of higher education. So the fact is that these loans that are getting forgiven are going to start accruing all over again the very next day. So I do hope that this announcement yesterday not only does what it's doing, which is providing relief to struggling borrowers, but also starts a more robust conversation to address the actual problem, which is the cost of higher ed.
Okay, and finally, Betsy, I'm sure in a day like today, there are student debt holders who say, well, hold on a second, I paid my loan back, and now, you know, we have this provision for others. What is your sense of that conversation, that debate among people who have student loan debt?
There's a pretty strong political divide on this issue, whether the government should be forgiving student loans in the first place. You know, my response to people that are saying, well, what about me? I paid off my student loans. You know, sometimes it's about timing. The reason that the Biden administration was able to do this is partly because of COVID. If you had asked me 3 years ago if there would ever be broad student loan forgiveness, I would have said, heck no. Mm. But a combination of things have come together to make it be able to happen.
Yeah. Betsy Mayat is founder of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors. Betsy, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
And we will have links to more information and Betsy's organization website at hereandnow.org.
Well, California is getting closer to putting an expiration date on gas-powered cars. The state is proposing a regulation that would end the sale of new cars that run only on gasoline by 2035. It's the latest step in California Governor Gavin Newsom's broader goal of cleaning up California's congested freeways. Let's bring in Michelle Krebs now, executive analyst for Cox Automotive. Michelle, welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, first, what's the impact of this proposed rule on consumers and the auto industry?
This move could accelerate the adoption of EVs across the country. For one, about a dozen other states that represent about a third of the country typically follow California's lead, so we'll see if they do the same thing. For automakers, it's really going to push them to accelerate their plans to build electric vehicles.
So how much sway does California really have on the rest of the auto industry? Because as you say, this will help accelerate the auto industry's transition to electric vehicles.
Well, California is the biggest car market in the U.S., and it's also the biggest electric vehicle market in the U.S., so it sort of leads the way. Now, there are vast differences between the states, but they are sort of the bellwether.
As a practical matter, there really aren't enough vehicles to meet demand and not enough places to charge them. Talk about how they're going to fill that gap.
Well, and I think the most important factor in this is on the demand side. Will consumers buy electric vehicles and will they be able to afford them? In our studies, it shows the number one obstacle to EV adoption is the price. The price of a regular gasoline-powered car is over $48,000, and right now EVs are averaging over $66,000. And yes, is there enough production? Are there enough batteries? How robust is the supply chain, especially for those critical minerals that we don't mine in the U.S. that are used in batteries? That's a big question. And of course, the EV charging infrastructure is a big challenge.
Yeah. And what's it going to take to fix that?
More EV chargers. And, you know, I think that we are seeing more being installed. The federal government has a program. States are doing that. Local governments, private industry, they're installing them. So I think that is a problem that can be overcome. What's not in my area of expertise, but I wonder about, is the robustness of the electric grid to support EVs.
Interesting. Well, as you say, these cars are expensive. The Inflation Reduction Act that just passed Congress includes a 10-year tax credit for electric vehicles. Do you think that'll help drive down prices at some point?
It's a little tricky because there are a lot of detailed requirements about the price of the vehicle, the incomes of the people buying them, where they are built and where the batteries are made, as well as where the battery minerals come from. So it is not an easy just check the box, I get a tax credit.
Mm. Well, environmentalists, of course, are praising the new regulation. I guess it now goes to the EPA. What are the next steps here, Michelle?
I don't know all the policy part of it, but I don't know how California will enact it, but that's just not my area of expertise.
So this is the broader goal here of cleaning up California's freeways. That's one aspect. Is anyone opposed to this?
opposed to the ban?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure that there are, you know, there are dealers who sell gas-powered vehicles. I'm sure there's automakers, you know, rely heavily now on profits and revenues from their gas-powered vehicles. Yes, they are moving in the EV direction. I think the timing may be, is this too fast for the industry, for the infrastructure? I think there's more questions just flat-out opposition.
We will keep answering those questions. Michelle Krebs is an executive analyst at Cox Automotive. Thanks so much for your time today, Michelle.
Thank you.
As of today, Idaho, Texas, and Tennessee have new bans on most abortions. This comes 2 months after the Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade. Idaho is proceeding despite a legal challenge from the Biden administration. In all, 11 states now have total bans, and by a Washington Post estimate, nearly 21 million people now have no access to elective abortions in their home states. For more, we have NPR Sarah McCammon on the line. Sarah, hello.
Hey, Scott.
So 2 months on from the overturning of Roe v. Wade, more than 10 states have banned abortion. Who is most affected by these recent changes in the states?
Certainly, people living in those now almost a dozen states with total or near total abortion bans, which are heavily concentrated in the Midwest and South, they're affected. And in general, the people who seek abortions are lower-income women, often women of color. More than half are already mothers, according to the Guttmacher Institute, which is a research group that supports abortion rights. Mm-hmm. And about half of people who seek abortions are below the federal poverty level. So this is just intensifying that for people who live in places where abortion access is now non-existent. It's obviously more challenging to go out of state if you don't have a lot of financial resources.
Mm-hmm. In the course of your reporting, you have spoken to people seeking care as well as reproductive health providers. What individual stories stand out to you?
I've spent time in Texas and Louisiana and other places over the last several months, you know, even before the Dobbs decision. And as I'm sure you know, Texas had the most restrictive abortion law in the country in place. This was SB 8 that prohibited most abortions after 6 weeks. Earlier this year, I went to Texas and interviewed a woman named Anna who had a very wanted pregnancy, but, you know, sadly had a miscarriage around 19 weeks, too early for any kind of intervention to save the baby. But she, you know, she went to the hospital, her water had broken. Doctors there refused to terminate the pregnancy, which they said would have been the standard of care. I talked to her doctor as well. They said the best thing for her fertility, would have been to terminate that, you know, non-viable pregnancy, but couldn't because of the Texas law. I also think, Scott, about a young mom I met in Louisiana right after the Dobbs decision. For a while there, there was sort of litigation challenging Louisiana's state abortion bans, and abortion rights advocates won a brief reprieve from that. And so a clinic that was actually shut down for a while was able to resume offering abortions. And I met a young mom who told me, you know, she already had three boys. She was in her late 20s and was, she told me, just so exhausted and had, you know, very difficult pregnancies, was in the hospital, and just could not imagine having another child. When the decision had come down, she panicked and thought she was going to have to go to New Mexico to terminate her pregnancy. Wound up being able to go and get that abortion in Louisiana, which was closer for her.
And just going back to the woman in Texas you started talking about, in the end, what did she do?
She wound up flying to Colorado to get an abortion there, where there are less restrictive laws. And she told me she was fortunate that she was able to do that. She had a job where she could take time off of work. The whole trip cost several thousand dollars, which she had. But she said, you know, there are many people who would not.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, three states are starting new restrictions today. Idaho, Texas, you've talked about Texas, and Tennessee. What are the specifics in those states?
Already those states have abortion restrictions on the books. What's happening now is that in many cases, more restrictive laws, laws that make abortion a felony as opposed to something you can sue to try to stop, are taking effect. In Texas, already abortion access is non-existent, but now abortion becomes a felony with narrow exceptions to save the life of a patient. Tennessee already had a law prohibiting most abortions after 6 weeks. Now abortions are all illegal with no exceptions. There is a very narrow carve-out in the law that may defend doctors against accusations if they've actually performed an abortion in an emergency situation. But that is, from what I've read from other reporting, a lot of lawyers are concerned about the way that law is written and what it will mean for doctors. In Idaho, also, there's approximately a six-week ban already in effect. Now it becomes a felony with narrow exceptions for rape, incest, and to save the pregnant woman's life.
Okay. In addition to abortion bans, are any states moving to ban abortion pills or emergency contraception medicines?
Sure. You know, abortion pills are actually the most common form of abortion now in the country, according to recent data from the Guttmacher Institute. Over half of abortions provided in this country are done not through surgery, but through an abortion pill protocol. Mm-hmm. Usually it's two pills in two different medications in succession. That's been approved by the FDA for more than 20 years now, has a very good safety record when used correctly under the right circumstances. And it's increasingly a common choice for people who either don't want surgery or don't want to travel to a doctor's office. In states with more supportive environments for access to abortion, it's possible to get these pills via a telemedicine appointment. If the doctor assesses the patient, determines they're a good candidate for that, then the pills can be mailed and taken at home with medical supervision, remote supervision. Mm-hmm. But a lot of states have already tried to make that difficult, have banned, for example, the use of telehealth for that purpose. Other states, if you know, a state that has an abortion ban, that applies to pills as well. So that means that prescribing abortion pills is no more legal than a surgical abortion. And states are trying, you know, it's much more difficult, though, to regulate that. It's much easier to close down an abortion clinic than to prevent someone from getting pills online or in the mail. And that is definitely a trend we're seeing more and more of, particularly in places where access is limited.
And Sarah, conversely, are there efforts in certain states to protect or expand access to abortion?
Yeah, this is something that abortion rights advocates have been pushing for a few years. We've seen some state legislatures take steps to expand the types of providers who can offer abortions or to, you know, provide funding for provider training, things like that. Also, there are ballot initiatives in a few states this November in Vermont and California, for example, that would sort of shore up the right to an abortion. A big state to watch, though, is Michigan. There's a ballot initiative there that's citizen-led. Citizens gathered signatures to put that on the ballot to affirm legal access to abortion in the state constitution. Voters will have a chance to weigh in November, as they will in several other states.
That is NPR's Sarah McCammon. Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
It's been more than 2 months since the FDA announced that kids under 5 could get vaccinated against COVID-19, but only 6% of children in that age group have received their first shot. Lisa Phillip of WBEZ in Chicago talked to doctors, moms, and their needle-shy children to find out why.
It's noon at the Esperanza Health Center in Little Village in southwest Chicago. Toddlers bounced nearly out of their parents' laps in the waiting room. But Anayeli Tellez's 4-year-old son is the exception.
He has an infection this year, and we want to see how is it going.
When asked about getting her son vaccinated against COVID-19, Tellez pauses for a moment.
I wasn't thinking about the vaccine for him, but his platelets are very low. So the doctors recommend to get the vaccine for him because an infection could be bad.
That was enough to convince Tellez. Her son has an appointment to get the vaccine this month. But persuasion isn't working for everyone. More than 40% of parents surveyed recently by the Kaiser Family Foundation said they will definitely not vaccinate their kids under 5.
I would say the majority of parents are denying it.
Jasmine Saavedra is a pediatrician with Esperanza Health Centers, which provides bilingual medical care. Saavedra has been talking to parents about the vaccine at each checkup. These happen pretty frequently before age 5.
It's offered at each visit, but even then it takes some convincing and it hasn't been very successful.
Parents tell her they worry about the safety of the vaccine for such small children, or they don't want their kids to get the COVID vaccine along with all the other required vaccinations.
Getting them back in has been a struggle.
Those parents who are open to getting their kids vaccinated sometimes have a hard time getting to appointments. Scott Thorpe is with the Chicagoland Vaccine Partnership, which works to make sure everyone can access the vaccine.
If you're a parent who has a day job, you're talking about taking your kid potentially out of daycare or kindergarten to go to a pediatrician or some vaccine site during regular business hours most of the time during your workday to get vaccinated.
Thorpe says that can be tough, especially if you live in places with fewer vaccine sites. He says you can see this play out in the racial breakdown of the city's vaccination rates. Just 2% of Black Chicagoans and 4% of Latinx Chicagoans under 5 have gotten at least one dose as of August 23rd. That's compared to 21% of white Chicagoans in the same age group. To confront that, some organizations are taking the vaccine to kids and their parents. Sangeeta Solshi works for the Carol Robertson Center for Learning. Her group hosted a vaccine clinic at its Early Childhood Education Center in Little Village this month. Solshi and other staff members tried different approaches to get families to register.
We have been, you know, meeting with parents during pickup and drop-off. We have set up tables for sign-up, providing any kind of information they need, answering their questions or any concerns they have.
Solshi heard from many parents who did not want their kids to get vaccinated yet.
They want to wait and watch and see others get it and then wait for some time and see how things go before they get their kids vaccinated.
Nearly a third of parents to kids under 5 surveyed by the Kaiser Family Foundation also felt this way.
So I think time might help.
That's Dr. Saavedra again with Esperanza Health. Her advice to other pediatricians is to stay in touch with parents taking the wait-and-see approach. She suggests doctors answer any questions parents may have about vaccine safety. For Here and Now, I'm Lisa Philip.
In France, there is something new on the menu at many wine bars. Non-alcoholic wine. Wait, what? In the wine capital of the world? Well, from Paris, reporter Rebecca Rossman took on the hardship assignment to sample some zero-alcohol selections with some wine connoisseurs.
Augustin Lebord quit drinking during the early stages of the pandemic 2 years ago.
Et du coup, c'est à force d'aller dans les bars, les
meeting up with friends in bars quickly became a frustrating experience, he says. His only non-alcoholic options were drinks like soda or fruit juice. So Lebord, a lawyer with a passion for side projects, started doing some internet research.
Donc voilà, c'est en cherchant, on voyait.
Turns out, he says, there was a whole range of alcohol-free beverages on the market. They just weren't on any menus. Then a light bulb turned on.
Bonjour, bienvenue déjà dans ce qui est donc la première cave sans alcool en France.
In April, Lebord opened Le Pain qui Boit, or the Drinking Peacock. It's France's first non-alcoholic beverage shop, complete with a selection of more than 300 products, including zero-proof beers, gins, whiskeys, and wines.
On part d'un vin donc qui a déjà fermenté.
After going through the traditional fermentation process, Lebord says the alcohol in the wine is evaporated using a special filtration process. He also expects the taste to become more refined as techniques improve and the zero-proof market grows, which it is.
Yeah, this is definitely not a fad.
Dan Metyer with the consultancy group Wine Intelligence says consumption of non-alcoholic wines across the global market has grown by 24% in the last year alone.
As part of the kind of lifestyle choice and all connected to the kind of big wellness trends that we've seen across the world.
But Metyer says that, unsurprisingly, growth has been slower in France than the US and much of Europe.
Particularly in kind of like traditional wine markets, it's a bit of a harder sell. You know, people are kind of have already well-established ideas about, you know, what wine is and what wine should taste like.
Like here at Le Baron Rouge, a wine bar in Paris's 11th arrondissement that's about as traditionalist as it can get. Opened in 1979, this tiny establishment is famous for serving wine from colossal wooden barrels.
I don't understand why you want to drink wine without alcohol.
That's sommelier Olivier Coulin.
But it's also true for the meat. You know, there is some vegan meat. It's crazy. And I don't understand why we need to eat something equal to the meat or to the wine or to the beer.
That's when I insist we do a tasting.
All right, I have two bottles here.
Bottles I've procured from Lebord's shop, including a white Sauvignon and a zero-proof champagne.
That's on pipicha. It's nice.
But then he goes for a second swig and isn't as impressed.
And the third one, Yeah, even less.
In other words, you won't be seeing any non-alcoholic wine here anytime soon. Those at this outdoor tasting, hosted by the Drinking Peacock, disagree. Charles Vauban says he's been trying to cut down on his alcohol consumption while his wife is pregnant.
In France, we always use the fact that wine is not about alcohol, it's all about culture, about gastronomy. And it's interesting to have this aspect in a non-alcoholic product.
In other words, he says, wine traditionalists should realize they all have the same goal, to prove France is producing some of the world's best wines, with or without alcohol. For NPR News, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Paris.
Ukrainian officials say two children were among more than two dozen people killed by a Russian missile strike on a train station yesterday, the day Ukrainians were celebrating independence from Russia. 6 months into a war that's galvanized Europe, isolated Russia, and left large swaths of Ukrainian ruins, it's worth examining why the capital city of Kyiv did not fall. Isabel Kershudian is Ukraine bureau chief with our editorial partners at The Washington Post, and she's written about the battle for Kyiv as part of a series in The Post about the war. Hi, Isabel.
Thank you for having me.
It's worth remembering that 6 months ago, the world thought that Kyiv would fall in a matter of days. And up until Russian rockets actually started falling in Ukraine, none of the top military or political leaders believed that an all-out assault was coming. You write about how soldiers on the ground were joking about President Biden's warning just before the rockets landed.
Yeah, I think most people, from military command to, you know, government officials, really believed that there was going to be something, but that something was probably going to be limited to the east, where Ukraine had already been fighting, you know, Russian-led separatist forces for the past 8 years. So I think they saw an expansion of that, you know, war, but weren't expecting really for Russia to go after Kyiv. And, you know, as you mentioned, there's these border guards who are right there by the border of Belarus. And all of a sudden they get attacked by kamikaze drones just hours after they had been, you know, laughing about it because they didn't expect it. And they were the first that came under attack. And that was at 4:15 a.m. on February 24th.
Well, there were several key decision points for the Ukrainians that sustained them day to day in the first period of the war. First, President Zelensky decided to stay in Kyiv. Tell us why that was so critical.
Yeah, it was critical because so many Western governments and, you know, foreign leaders had really been instructing him to kind of move himself out of Kyiv, to have a contingency plan, to govern from, you know, Western Ukraine or even in exile from Poland potentially. But he was very insistent that if he did that, Russia would have an easier time capturing the capital, that how would troops feel if, you know, their leader left? And he actually started to get very annoyed with all of these requests for him to leave or offers to evacuate him. You know, he's not saying everybody felt this way, but he does suspect that some foreign leaders, you know, kind of wanted him potentially out of the picture because they didn't expect Ukraine, you know, to survive this assault. And it would have been easier for them, you know, rather than this long protracted war in the middle of Europe, easier if, you know, Russia does as expected, takes Kyiv in 3 days. And they can just come to an agreement with Russia at that point, negotiate directly with them.
You write that despite not having enough weapons, the Ukrainian military was nimble and even allowed their junior officers to make tactical decisions, unlike the Russian army. What was it like on the ground for those soldiers?
It was a little chaotic, honestly. They were sort of forced to make decisions on the ground because they didn't have the communications ability, you know, to even get orders from higher up. You know, a big part of maybe some of our misconceptions of the battle for Kyiv and really the war in general is because we as civilians didn't lose service, we assume that Russia failed to jam any communications. But that's actually not true. They were jamming, and quite effectively, to where soldiers just a couple miles apart from each other often weren't able to communicate. And so this led to a lot of confusion. And it was just very difficult to kind of make this an organized movement going forward and kind of all operating on the same page. So a lot of it was really kind of decided, you know, spur of the moment and in the moment.
So with all the confusion on the ground, Isabel, how did the military turn the tide? What were they able to accomplish?
A big thing for them was, you know, their own natural terrain and understanding it. They had Russian forces at that point kind of around the Irpin River. That's when General Alexander Sirsky, who was in charge for, you know, the defense of Kyiv, starts to find, you know, local civilians who understand how the dam system works. And he enlists the help of this man named the Diver. At least that's what they call him. His identity has not been revealed. And he explains there's a way to raise the river level. And that would kind of help them, you know, prevent the Russians from being able to cross, or at least make it incredibly difficult.
And really, so it all came down to understanding the terrain, but the village-to-village fighting, right? And the sheer determination of ordinary Ukrainians, the entire population jumping into the fight.
Yes, that was a huge part and something that, you know, Russia, the Kremlin, really underestimated. They thought they would be welcomed into Ukraine as invaders, as, you know, a regime change, whatever. And instead, people, you know, would inform on where Russian positions are. Thousands and thousands of people signed up to get guns, you know, those first couple days. And then, you know, there was other kind of forms of volunteering, just, you know, making food for the military or bringing them blankets or just kind of helping source, you know, various equipment or bulletproof vests. So all of that played a huge role that it really did. When you look at the manpower as far as, you know, how many people the Russian military has versus how many people the Ukrainian military has, obviously it's a huge disadvantage for the Ukrainians. But when you start to kind of factor in all of these civilians kind of ready to do whatever to defend their territory, then it becomes a little bit more even.
Well, and the offensive also exposed serious systemic problems within the Russian military that Putin himself had spent billions to rebuild.
Yeah, I mean, there were pretty basic logistics issues that I think nobody really expected the Russian military to kind of run into. You would see these long convoys that would just get stuck because, you know, they ran out of fuel. There were a lot of instances of, you know, tanks kind of abandoned on the side of the road for the same reason. And then they really struggled to adjust when, you know, they couldn't take Gostomel airfield, you know, or at least land their heavy equipment there. They couldn't adjust when, you know, their plan of 3 days didn't work out. They had logistical supply issues that seemed really basic. You know, this assessment of 3 days that a lot of Western intelligence agencies had made was based on an assumption of, okay, if they fight the way we would fight, they can do this in 3 days. But they didn't fight the way, you know, a U.S. military or a British military would fight. And instead, just really exposed themselves as having a lot of kind of very basic issues.
You write with extraordinary detail about the daily toll of war. It was so intense on the Ukrainian side that the defense minister needed to see a therapist because he was so emotionally and physically traumatized. And that was just the beginning.
Yeah, he said that he realized at some point that it was going to be a marathon and not a sprint, that he needed to kind of take better care of himself and get some sleep and eat. I mean, you know, for a lot of people, there's a lasting effect to this, even if it only lasted 30-something days.
You write that Russia calculated that Ukrainian defenses would quickly unravel, that Moscow could install a puppet government. Instead, you write that the battle for Kyiv would represent the biggest foreign policy blunder in the 22-year rule of Vladimir Putin. How will we look back on those first days of the war?
I think we'll look back on, you know, kind of seeing this Ukrainian heroism and really a lot of Russian mistakes. Had they, you know, maybe had better reconnaissance on the ground or anything like that, they might have actually been able to take Kyiv quite quickly, maybe if they had better flexibility. And now, you know, what's happened is why this is such a huge blunder for, you know, Putin and the Kremlin is that they're locked into this long slog of a war in the East where there's not a ton of gains or losses on either side. And it's really put Russia in a worse place. It's made NATO stronger. And so it's really accomplished a lot of the things opposite of what he wanted. And you don't get the ultimate prize, which was Kyiv.
That's Isabel Kershudian, Ukraine bureau chief for The Washington Post. Isabel, tremendous reporting. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
We want to take a moment to mark the passing of a towering icon in the Southwest, a 40-foot-tall saguaro cactus, known locally as Strong Arm, crashed into the desert floor near Tucson earlier this month. Strong Arm was close to 200 years old and had a staggering 34 arms when it died. Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd is based in Arizona, and he called Jason Grodman, the National Resources Supervisor for the Marana Parks and Recreation Department.
And tell us, what happened? How did this beautiful creature fall over?
Yeah, so our strong-armed saguaro was really the anchor of our Tortolita Preserve, and a storm event had strong enough winds and rain, and it fell our 40-foot-tall strong arm.
Oh, so it wasn't a matter of old age. This was the weather.
Yes, absolutely. The strong arm did have a bacterial infection, which did weaken the saguaro. However, storm and wind effect was really the finisher of the saguaro.
Well, saguaros, they're so precious to the Sonoran Desert in the southwestern United States and Mexico. It's the only place in the world where these plants grow. This one was extra special because it was gigantic, 34 arms, 40 feet tall. How did it hit you when you saw it on the ground?
Yeah, it was quite a shock. Since it is such an impressive species, it was part of the Tortolita Preserve skyline. It was a landmark for folks who use the path and trail system in the area, and the backdrop for countless photos, folks riding horses through the area and just enjoying the outdoors. I did receive a lot of photos from folks in the area once they heard the news.
Kind of like a local celebrity.
Absolutely. It was very well known, for sure.
Yeah. Well, like all saguaros, it was also home to a great little ecosystem. In fact, people in the Sonoran Desert call these saguaro cactus saguaro motels because of all the bugs and the birds and the wildlife that rely on it. Tell us what they lost.
Yeah, absolutely, Peter. And that is a great description. This particular saguaro was home to a great horned owl, numerous Gila woodpeckers, and other birds that use the saguaro as housing, shelter, and for rearing young. The saguaro itself forms calluses around these homes and holes in there, so it doesn't really negatively affect the health of the saguaro. So those species we'll have to move on to other saguaros within the preserve. We do have hundreds of saguaros still standing that can accommodate and become new saguaro motels.
And by the way, the arms, gigantic arms, they're splayed all over the ground. It made just a huge mess when this thing fell. But I understand that you plan on leaving the arms on the ground. Why is that?
Absolutely, Peter. We're trying to be as delicate as possible with the saguaro now that it's moved on to its next phase of decomposition. And some birds and animals will continue to use the cactus for years to come. It's going to be a source of moisture, a lot of water stored in all of those arms. Again, it's going to serve a purpose on into the future as well.
Really, tell me more about how the cactus is a water source. It's just because all the water is stored up inside this cactus and now it's going to be released?
Yeah, right. Peter, so the 34 arms that the strong arm had is an adaptation in order to store more water for its survival. You know, a saguaro like that, that's, you know, well-fed and full of water, every, like, foot section can be up to 90 pounds. So now in death, as the cacti will slowly decompose, and it's so dry in the desert normally, those arms will continue to house some moisture, which is extremely valuable to any species from coyote all the way down to the carpenter ant.
Well, finally, one thing that I can't help but think about is that if this cactus stood watch over the desert for something like 200 years, 150 years, mm-hmm. that's almost twice as long as the state of Arizona has been a state. Can you just imagine the profound change that this entire region has gone through on its watch?
Yeah, so over the last 200 years, the landscape has gone through an enormous change. It's really time for us to evaluate our land use practices and also treasure spaces like the Tortolita Preserve that are there to continue this tradition of conservation and open space, and we can enjoy the saguaros for many years to come.
Jason Groudman is with the Marana Parks and Recreation Department. Jason, thanks so much for speaking with us. We'll have pictures of Strong Arm in life and in death at hereandnow.org. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Peter.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Scott Tong. It's Here and Now.